Weekend update, Central Division.
I know. What do we think about this Friday? I'm feeling very excited the way I get at the end of the week. What about you? Is this okay?
Yeah, I'm good with it. I wonder if people do, you know, I don't know. I get good feedback generally. So I don't know, maybe all the bad feedback's hiding out there, but I think it's interesting, like nice change of pace. I don't know if it's like the permanent place on the schedule, but I'm into it. I like Friday.
Yeah, I do too. I'm in that, the brief feeling of incredible efficiency, having like prepared my tax kind of information from the accountant, which like gives you this illusion of control over your life that comes completely undone when they tell you, you owe whatever it is. And you're like, oh my God. But for one day, I feel like my life is in order. Lots of overseas meals, looking through the old American Express itemized card. You're like, oh, that really did add up quite catastrophically, or well, depending on how you look at it. It's amazing to see your life just reduced to itemized, you know.
Oh yeah, to a pie chart. Yeah, on Amex. I bought an expensive ticket to Europe last night, and I was kind of happy to be spending the money because I'm like, I got to get the spend. I got to do it for the status. I have to do it. And ooh, so it makes it such a different game. It's pretty
they've
bad.
They've changed the graphics on Delta now. And I actually have my miles for the whole year, but the spend is going to be tough now. And they've put that into a pie chart that is sort of gaming it out. And
yeah,
I mean, I might as well go right into this. I'm about to start. I'm going on a trip. And I would say it's the trip is the exciting part, but the most exotic thing I will be doing is flying JetBlue out of Terminal 5 at 6:30 in the morning. I was soliciting answers for this. It's to Nassau, and then from Nassau on to Long Island in the Bahamas where I fish. And I found the very upsetting, you know, everyone's like, oh, 3 hours before international.
No way. No one follows. No way.
2 hours. But when I go to these other parts of the airport and other airlines, I don't know what to expect. So I looked up just what time they even open, right? What time the ticket counters open at JetBlue Terminal 5? 2:30 in the morning. Now I kind of want to like who's at the airport at 3:30? Because they say they have a 5:30 a.m. you know, international flight. I'm like, is that like that to me seems like you go there, you're alone, and you can't even go through security. You know, you're like waiting there. They're like, oh no, the union doesn't start until 5. So you just stand without, I'm not sure. I will report back. You said 5 a.m. to show up for a 6:30.
I would show. I mean, if you, it's only gonna take you 30 minutes to get there. Okay. So if you left it, I don't know, if you left at 4:15.
Here's the deal. I just booked my car 3:45.
No,
I can't.
It's not going to be the international. There's not going to be any international bit like on the way there. They're not going to like do anything different. It's not international security to go to the Bahamas.
No, it's that I have this feeling that if JetBlue does this, they're doing it for a lot of flights. Like there's going to be one to Cancun, one to whatever.
Why don't you just look at the schedule and see what's on the schedule?
It's Sunday morning. I'm absolutely.
Oh God, you're going to be sitting around forever. Let us know. No, yeah, this is.
I will. I'm going to check in.
You're going to be there at 4:15, Coggins. You're going to be there 4:20 max.
I have consulted with some of my early arrivers. Matt Hranek being one of them,
and we agreed at
4:30. No, for sure. No, I would much rather be there half an hour early and relaxed. And I'm aiming for 4:30.
There's no lounge. You're not going to be able to hit a lounge because you're flying JetBlue. You hit the priority pass lounge.
Have you heard, Michael, about periodically I'm hearing that like the LaGuardia renovation is great. Have you heard this at all?
But yeah, I've been there. It's beautiful. New LaGuardia is amazing. It's incredible.
So is that where is that Delta mostly like connecting to? It's kind of like regional Delta. Is that sort of the?
Well, I think LaGuardia, you know, LaGuardia can't have flights further away than basically Denver, right? It's limited by like what, where, how far away, like it was, I think, meant to limit like how big of an airplane could come in. It's like a noise thing. So, so it's like not, you know, it's not huge planes there, but The Delta terminal, I haven't been in the other terminals. I think they're all pretty nice because I think they all got redone. But the Delta terminal there is insane. It's legitimately beautiful. And it's like LaGuardia is like unrecognizable, like compared to what it used to be. I mean, it's yeah, it's great. LaGuardia is such a great thing, you know, so close, it's easy.
I've got to rethink this because because of where I live, sneak out to Newark because it's so close.
Yeah.
And but that area where there are regional flights to Minneapolis and Atlanta is like sort of the most decrepit part. I think it's like the Penn Station of airports. So should I be crossing over, take a little longer to get to LaGuardia to enjoy this new feeling? Or are you?
I would go to Newark. I always flew out of Newark. I mean, I was like a United person and I lived on the West Side. So I always used Newark. Plus, you could take the train to Newark. It's kind of guaranteed.
I did that the other day, actually.
You took the train.
I didn't want to pay $150 from Newark into town because they do all these tolls and weird little naughty things. And even though it was midnight, I just took my huge bag, trained it into Penn Station.
Yeah.
Had to walk in a very dubious tunnel to get to the subway. Like, really not great. I was like the last person who went through before they put the fence in for the night. I was like, if I don't make it to the other end, could I possibly get, you know, blockaded in here? And took the train down. And yeah, it was not bad. I felt like I was doing one thing economically savvy for once. And
so the train is good from New Jersey Transit into the city is pretty convenient. Once I took the train to Newark and got on the express on accident.
Yeah.
And it either skipped the airport. No, I don't think any of them skipped the airport. I think I just missed it. And because I was on the express, it went to Princeton. and it was so long down and so long back up, I missed my flight. So I had to just like take the train all the way back to Penn Station.
Ooh.
And then go home and then go back the next day.
It's almost like at that moment, just spend the day in Princeton. You're like, oh, this is nice.
That's funny. I wouldn't have even thought of that, but that's true. I was just thinking for your early AM JFK, you could like go to the TWA hotel would have been easy.
I'm the reason why this is happening is that I need to make, this is the only way to make this connection. It's the only day of the week that you can do it. And so if you fly, then you get this connecting flight on Bahamas Air, which sent me an email saying they changed the time of that flight, which is fine. It's later. It's even better. But they said that they reaccommodated the flight to a later hour. The phrase was reaccommodated, which I typed into my thing and it's underlined red. So I think they made that word up. Just fantastic, like euphemism of like, we changed the time. We've reaccommodated you to 45 minutes later. It's just great. I just tried to imagine the meeting or who came up with that word in NASA or wherever Bahamas Air is HQ.
Probably. I'm not sure if this is true. We'd have to get Rob to fact check, our friend Rob, but his wife told me that there was a thing where you could suggest a word to the dictionary.
Hmm.
And it has to be like commonly used and written, I think, in, you know, like reaccommodate. And I guess she submitted deplane.
Oh, yeah.
And great. I think it was accepted. I think she's like responsible for getting it in the dictionary.
That
which is like a pretty great little party fact.
No, I love like I find whether or not a word counts based on if it works in the spelling bee, the New York Times little digital puzzle. And you try to try words like Googled, they accept, which is pretty wild. And I also think it's a real power move now that I'm typing JetBlue into my texts and stuff. If it autocorrects a business's name to capitalize they capitalize the B in blue and you're like, whoa, or like iPhone and they put the capital P. Yeah. Obviously, it's an Apple product, but like that's another level of kind of corporate domination when your just word enters the spell check. How are you handling not being made the creative director of Louis Vuitton? I know there was a couple of interviews.
Yeah,
you went kind of far down there. Are you taking it all right?
Yeah, I do feel like, you know, just the family, you know, they're just not happy with me. You know, I feel like some of our collaborations could have been better, and Just yeah, I'm disappointed. I think it's all related to me moving to the West Coast, Coggins. But Pharrell, I feel like, is on the West Coast. Unbelievable, you know.
It's funny because this seems like important in some way, totally symbolic, and yet utterly, in a practical sense, meaningless. Like, I don't even, I forget that Louis Vuitton makes men's clothes. Like, I wouldn't know like what the label looked like or if anyone we know has them. I mean, I know there's other reasons what they're trying to do, but it's just such a funny, it's an odd thing to see on the front page of the business section.
Yeah, it's, I think that, I don't know. I think it's kind of just symbolic, right? Yeah. Like, I don't know, maybe not. Who knows? I don't know. I don't spend a lot of time thinking about Vuitton. So generally, I think you might be surprised to hear that.
Well, it was very interesting getting your newsletter yesterday because I was walking to P&S to have breakfast. S&P. Oh, I keep calling it. I wrote down, I think that's Partners in Spade, and my mind has inverted it. S&P. And then your newsletter came out yesterday. You're dabbling as a food critic, Azira. I was curious. Why don't you tell people what Eisenberg's was? Basically, on today's show, I have five pretty interesting topics we're going to get Michael's opinion on that are kind of in the news, kind of in our zone. And I think they should be pretty good. I'm surprisingly prepared. I've never written things down before for a podcast. I have notes. I have a quote written down here.
What happened?
I don't know. I was inspired. I wanted to hear, there were some interesting things in the news. And then also I want to hear about S&P, and just why don't you remind people what Eisenberg's is for those who don't know, and your personal connection to it?
Yeah, Eisenberg's is like a little luncheonette, like a little diner thing that's been around since like I think 29, which is a long time, but not longer than, you know, it's not like McSorley's, or there's other places I think that have been around longer, but I think to start in 29 is a pretty crazy when you think about what was happening in the world in 1929.
Yeah. Wild.
So it's an old place, and they had, it really didn't change much. Like, it's not different than a lot of diners. They just never updated a lot of it. It felt like kind of going back in time. It really felt like old New York. And so I think I found it originally because I worked on 18th and 6th. So and Eisenberg's is like in the 20s on 5th Ave, like, what is it,
22nd.
So I would go there when I worked, you know, a little bit away, and I would order from there. And it was, I don't know, it was just like a night. I would go sit there like at, you know, my lunch break, basically, and eat lunch there. And I've been there, you know, a few hundred times. I haven't been there like, you know, I didn't go every day.
It was before Sweet Green and all those types of things. I mean, you're talking about 15 or 20 years ago when you went there. And it was before, like, when there still were diners and there wasn't healthy fast food or whatever they call that now, or apps or any of the sort of thing. And you went and you sat. Okay. So just
I think like most people, if they were eating lunch at this point, this was like 2003, 2004 in that zone. I think most people, if they were eating lunch, you know, they would go to like a bodega or whatever.
Yeah. Right.
And I knew a shirt maker that was in that building. McNary once like had he shot like a lookbook there once. McNary would always go there too. So like that in the like second chapter of like Eisenberg's in my life was like with McNary and with this guy, Carl Goldberg, and who's a shirt maker who was in the building and some other people. And you would just see that there were a lot of regulars. And then this one regular bought, I think they were selling it and he bought it and basically like preserved it. But I don't think he was like a restaurant guy. Mm-hmm. He was like just doing it more because he loved it. And it had really like stayed the same like that entire time, probably like up until, you know, 3 years ago or something. And so I just like had gone there a lot and just had like a lot of like personal affection for it. It wasn't like the best place you've ever eaten, you know?
Right.
Which is like sort of the thing
about it.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's a place that people, even if they didn't go there, were very invested in it staying the same way because it didn't. Like, it has a very specific level of like unfinishedness about it, you know, like it's kind of it's just on the near side of being dingy, but in a way that's sort of reassuring.
Yeah.
You know, like it's not pretending to be anything it isn't. It's like a, I mean, you could say it's like a little like Second Avenue Deli or one of those, or like the one on Houston Street. But it does, it's smaller, but it's got that feeling like that it's unchanged for a long time. Like people never wanted it to change. And if it was for sale, people would always flip out.
I mean, I really, I was thinking about this more and I kind of mentioned it, but I didn't really fully develop the thought. But if you go to New Haven, there's a few mm-hmm. famous pizza places in New Haven, Sally's, mm-hmm. Frank Pepe. There's a couple others, right? But Sally's and Frank Pepe like are always just really, really busy. And like, you know, mm-hmm. just like people are like saw some Food Network show mm-hmm. or whatever it is, like, you know, and I think, you know, so there's like a huge line at Sally's and it's, you know, Sally's is kind of a dump. It's not, you know, it's not like a fancy place at all. And it's really busy. It's worth going there, right? It's mm-hmm. worth doing it and like eating the white clam pizza and all mm-hmm. that stuff and like experiencing it. But like when I go to New Haven, I just don't go to Sally's. I can't deal with that. Like it's mm-hmm. not, it's not worth it to me to deal with like the scrum,
right?
Like the crazy amount of people. So I would go to like Bar or go to Modern or go to a couple other places that are like just as good, I think, pizza wise, or almost as good, but like no hassle, you know? And that's what Eisenberg's is. It's like, it's not Katz's.
Yeah,
it's not as good as Katz's, but it's also like no hassle. And that was right. like the beauty of it, right? It wasn't meant to be great. And that like goes back to the coffee conversation. It's like middle ground. It's like, we don't need great coffee. We don't want shitty gas station coffee. We just want normal coffee. And that's like what's missing basically in the world, the middle ground of everything.
Fantastic. I mean, yeah, really interesting, really good point. I think, so yeah, fast forward, I don't know, it was because of COVID or what, but it was finally sold to these.
Well, it was sold to someone else, this like group from San Francisco. And they like looked even more dubious. Like they were trying to open one in SF and it was just getting really weird. I don't know what they were doing or what they were thinking. Maybe like license it and make it like a chain or something, you know?
Yeah. And so it ended up being taken over by Brooklyn Guys. They didn't really change it too much. It was actually a really great New York Times restaurant review, which like the best reviews are about more than just the food. And Pete Wells is great on this topic. And really captured, like he definitely understood the charm of the old place. And even that charm, we have to say, is like extremely understated. So there was a lot
of concern. It's not charming, really.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the beauty of it, if beauty is a word, is like that it's pretty much left alone. And when you were there, you were connected to some older place. Like it almost could be in a train station, you know, like it's got a feeling like it's just been there. Like it's kind of an unusual part of town. You wrote about it also for A Continuous Lean. Like I consider that to be a real ACL early, you know, original post, like where I was, I may not have even known you. It's like, oh, this person who wrote this, you, is an interesting, like is into cool things and is connected in a nice way. So I associate it with you in a way that's nice.
I love this kind of stuff, like Eisenberg's original, like what it was. Mm-hmm. Like you, if you go to McSorley's, it's cool. It's old. It's unique. Like the way, you know, it's like light and dark mm-hmm. and the peanuts and all that stuff. Yeah, yeah. And it's like the interiors.
Sawdust. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, let's be real. It's like Colonial Williamsburg, right? It's like really, ooh, yeah. It feels like you're at Disneyland. Like it doesn't feel real. It's like overcooked in a way. Right. And Eisenberg's was never like that. You could tell like the place was like marginally dilapidated and you're like, no one would do this on purpose. Right.
Yes. No, that fine line, I think something has happened and now we can like bring this into the modern age, like Finelli, McSorley's, Corner Bistro, these places, the places you're talking about in New Haven, like they build on themselves, partly because it's easier to find out about them, partly because of social media. And then you post your Instagram or whatever. And people might be there for a reason to connect to something that they don't have in other parts and places in their life, but the experience gets changed in a way. And I think it's really hard to balance those things. And so what did you think of the new S&P when you went?
So I think, you know, I think I was like more disappointed originally, not at like the Court Street Grocers guys that took it over or what it became. it was just more like symbolically about how I feel like New York has changed, but it's not that like it, New York's always changing, and that's like part of the deal. And part of it was like related to me not living there. Right. And like my own issue with that. And, you know, so I think like I was like really feeling like bigger things where it's like, man, if like I just felt like when I originally sort of freaked out about it was just like, this sucks. Like New York's so annoying. Like this, you know, it doesn't need to happen to Eisenberg's. Like it can happen to other places. I don't care.
Right.
And it's like Dean and DeLuca goes away. It's like, that's a shame. But like Dean and DeLuca kind of sucked, you know? So I'm just like, you know, it was cool that it was there all those years, but like, I didn't think the food was good. And it was kind of annoying. But so, you know, I just felt like, oh, it's annoying that Eisenberg's had to like, this had to happen to it. And like, all, now all these people are like discovering it and going there and seeking it out. And, you know, it's like the Food Network TV show happened on it basically. And that's like, to me, disappointing because it was like an old place, but we went there, I went early. We were going to meet up and then we just sort of like didn't close the loop on it. So it didn't work out, but I went like pretty early and it wasn't crowded and there were like normal New Yorker people there, which was reassuring. And I tried a bunch of stuff that I had always ordered there. And I thought it was honestly going to be better than it was. It wasn't really better. It was a little bit better. Some of it like wasn't really better. And it kind of left me thinking like, I just don't understand like what the hype is about here. I mean, it's good that they did it. And I think the menu's good and like no criticism of those guys. And like, they're probably, the thing's going to survive now probably a lot longer because they're doing it.
Yeah.
And they have a good business. So it's good for them to do it. You know, I think it's not easy to have a successful restaurant. I can appreciate that.
Yeah. So I went yesterday and I think the thing that they did that's really smart is that they didn't try to make it cuter than it was, reinvent it in a major way, piggyback off what you liked about it, and then transform it into something that it never was intended to be. Like it feels still idiosyncratic and almost like strangely old-fashioned, but not in that Williamsburg way that you're talking about. Like it's, if you went in, it was pretty empty. Like the people who work there are kind of funky, like look like art school or older ladies. Like they aren't like really, nothing hipster about it.
Yeah.
Nothing overly precious about it. And some of the things are just really good, but you wouldn't quite know it if you didn't even, if you hadn't read articles or the people next to you weren't taking photos. And I didn't quite get that feeling. I went at a good time for those people who live in New York. Like I was talking to the woman at the front and it's kind of before the lunch rush, after breakfast is a good time to go. If you're like, if you're eating very late breakfast at like 11, it's sort of a good time.
That's kind of when I was in there too. Trip.
And I had this their version of sort of a breakfast sandwich with like, which was incredibly good. They call it like the little Shoney or something. It's got a name. It's like scrambled eggs, some cheese, pickle on there, and pastrami. And it was freaking awesome. And that totally indifferent egg cream, whatever. And it was like, it was fun. It was nice. And it was, but I was interested and impressed that they didn't make it like the thing that you're worried about, they didn't do to, that one would be worried about, they didn't do to it. Like they didn't try to make it all about them, which is really, really smart. Like it's kind of unfinished and almost like if you just went in there, you'd be like, oh, this was good, you know, which is sort of strange because most people don't do that.
They're obviously very smart the way they did this, right? They could like appreciate it. I think that they came from like a general place of appreciation for it. You know, I think like as far as like ownership changes is probably as good as it could be, right? For someone like me, just in terms of like it, you know, it could be a lot worse, right?
Oh,
I mean, it could be a million times worse.
Yeah, I would say they're like benign, you know, harmless overseers. They've made a few things that are quite good, like the pickles are good. Like they've made some effort where they've located things that they think can be smartly done. And I bet in a year or 2 years when no one cares anymore, or there's another new place to get revved up about or mad at or stand in line, it will be really good. And it's also funny, like it's very close to Eataly, where there's like a ton of those types of fast counters within that place. Like that's kind of changed during COVID too, but there to go there, you got to be in a, it's just such a funny thing to find on Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. Like it's so specific and it isn't really speaking to what most, like do most people want borscht or matzo ball soup or pastrami or tuna on rye? Like, not, that's such an archaic thing now that it might, maybe that's a, it will be a stalwart for that.
I mean, Flatiron is kind of a forgotten little corner, right? It's mm-hmm. like not, it's never like sort of changed like massive retail right there. And I mean, it's a little bit lower on Fifth. The retail's like more developed, but not in that part of Fifth. I think people probably will move on at some point. And, you know, I think it's fine. I'm not super excited about it, but it's not for me though either, you know, and I'm also like being super precious about this and whatever. So I can recognize that, well, but what did you think about what I wrote about it? Like, do you feel like I'm off on this?
I always like hearing people who have, like, you have a really strong connection to it. So you like it, the changes mean more to you, and then the perceived changes, meaning like it becoming more public in a way, like it's not just that it's not a secret, but it's not, you have a little less ownership of it or propriety toward it. And I didn't even know about like the McNary stuff. So like, if I was you, I would be very annoyed. I never had such a strong feeling toward it just because it wasn't in my loop. I mean, I have other diners that I used to go to, like the Waverly, and then they kind of renovated at one point, which was just so funny because it was like, why are you making something that's like the 50s? Like that people like the 70s, which they don't like you're not making, it's just so funny. But it, like, when those things change, it was like when Finelli got popular and there's outdoor dining now, and young people who, I'm like, what's going on here? These are like, this is so funny to me. And I understood what you said. I think you were a little harsh on it, but that's fine. Like, you've earned that. And I hope that I was prepared for the worst, so I was pleasantly impressed. But, you know, if I went and it was like super crowded and people are photographing everything, it would drive me nuts. So I think it's like not an everyday place. It's like if you're in the neighborhood and at the right time, like, it can be fun. And if I was with you and we got a table in the back and we just tried a bunch of stuff, I think that would be great.
Yeah, I think it's good. I mean, I think in the right conditions, it's good. The problem is, it used to, you could just go if you were there, you would just go. Now it's like, if you're there, okay, what time is it? Can we deal with this? You know, and it ratchets down the availability of something. Right. And it's a different beast than like if it were in Soho, like Finelli, like, you know what the deal is there. Yeah. I've actually, like, I never liked Finelli, but then I warmed to it later because I'm like, it's amazing. Like, it's still here.
Yeah.
You know, the deli I used to go to every day, like, became an Etro store. Like, that's fucking annoying.
No, it's every time. And like, they closed one of the Korean places down there, the delis that had flowers. I was outside.
The one on Prince Street. I lived across, like, across the street from there. Yeah. At the end.
It's tough. I mean, you're going to have, you know, when I moved to New York, like, Finelli was where we went and Bob was bartending, and you're going to have, like, the thing that Eisenberg seems like what you're saying, that you can go there at any time. And as soon as you're like, oh, wait, it's lunchtime, we can't go. It's like, wait, what are you talking? Like, the whole point is to have lunch there, you know? And now it's like, you've got to be like, wait a minute, hold on. We got to go to the, like, it's like, you can't get coffee in the morning. What's happening? But I totally understand it. And I think I feel like in a larger sense, it's hard to disconnect the experience of some place from the people who go there and how they're experiencing it. So if you go to like Moody's Diner in Waldorf, Maine, or if you go to, like, I went to some place in Tennessee, like a crazy barbecue place, they serve Triscuits and coleslaw, all sorts of weird things I'd never even like seen before, like lines, tons of people. It's like these places that are far from cities, they're still being kind of, you're experiencing them in kind of a boxed in way. And I think that's what that's the, like, Instagramization of like travel that makes a lot of people uneasy, because they're trying to kind of tick off the box. And I've written about this, and obviously we've talked about it a lot, but we don't need to go all the way down.
And I've done that stuff too. I'm like guilty of that, you know?
Sure.
So I think we've all done that. It's like not a criticism of that. You know, this isn't really a criticism of anything. It's like more a lamenting of like the changing of the world. And like, as a person, you don't want it to change. You know, I don't want to get older. I don't want to think about my New York being different. Like, this is what I'm pissed off about. It has nothing to do with Court Street Grocers or whatever.
walking up there, walking up Fifth, you know, you walk past 16th Street and Fifth, where the Paul Smith store used to be. And like that store represented where I went before I even lived in New York, represented so much to me. It was sophisticated in a way that I hadn't experienced. It was English in a way I didn't know existed. A store that had books and sold toothbrushes and crazy things from Japan, not to even mention all their clothes. And when that store left, that was sad. And every store that goes into it makes that space worse. And that's a real metaphor for retail. And even the new Paul Smith store in Soho is not remotely the same. It's more anonymous, more luxurious, and doesn't have any of that charm or idiosyncrasy. And so, yeah, we're running out of places, you know, or you got to like go and, I mean, you got to find something that maybe you didn't like before, but you go at a weird time or who knows, it's just, it's tough out there.
Yeah, it's like the strategy thing is like what I really don't want. You know, I don't want any more strategy in my life.
Well, basically. Okay, so this leads me to my next thing that's, I think, related. There have been these articles about Austin. There was one in the business section about real estate that actually Liz Lambert was quoted in. And there's an incredible article by Lawrence Wright, you know, he's a Pulitzer Prize winner, wrote The Looming Tower, in The New Yorker, about how Austin has changed. Mm-hmm. And there's a quote in that, which I absolutely recommend for everyone. I'm just discovering that there's an Hermes store in Austin, which is just nutty. But there's a quote in there that is totally related to S&P and all this stuff. It's like, it's talking about nostalgia and the way they wanted Austin to be and keep Austin weird. And now it's the 11th largest city in America. It's the most transformed American city over the last 20 years for a variety of reasons that are very interesting and somewhat sad, but we'll get into that. But here's a quote about nostalgia. He says, nostalgia is a way of remembering when things were simpler. It also makes us forget that simple things can be boring and frustrating. And I thought that was really good because we look back and think about Finelli or Eisenberg's or Austin or these times we were younger and we missed those simpler times, but also forgetting that like maybe the coffee was bad or Bob was being weird at Finelli or maybe you couldn't do these things, but you, or you know, Paris was one way or your childhood was in it. And I was really you know, we used to go to Austin a fair amount, and I'm sure when we went, like, I think of that as being a simpler time. I'm sure people were like, oh, you were there for South by Southwest, it was already ruined or something. Or I went to, you know, Finelli as soon as I moved to New York and thought it, like, not that I discovered it by any means, but like was very connected to it. But that was like 20 years after its prime, you know, and mm-hmm. But you think about those things in a way that that are, it's not that you misremember Eisenberg's or any of these places, but it's easy to fetishize the past because we're not focusing on the negative part of it. We're just focusing on what we missed.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's interesting. You know, I think we remember when you really, like if you see a video of something you were at and then you sort of like sync up, like if you watch some video from like South by in 2010, and then you kind of sync that up with your memory, you're like, I'm really manipulating this memory to be a certain way.
Oh, because the video is maybe not as...
Yeah, like we're piecing together, we're taking like a whole experience,
right?
And thinking of the five best things. Pulling out like, five little nuggets that were amazing, five little moments in 5 years. And then we base everything off that. And then, and as that sits within us, right? And we bring that up, the more we bring it up, like in you recall it in your head, like the more I feel like it gets embellished.
Sure.
Right. And gets better and better and better. It's like your story that you tell. The fish gets bigger, right, or whatever.
Right, of course. I mean, not me, but other people that's known to happen. But the funny thing about this, and I keep coming to Finelli or Awesome, is like the people are there because they love something that it stands for. But then by moving to Austin or by patronizing the bar or whatever it is, you kind of start to transform it. And I think it's easy to blame the people who do that, but we've all done that. Like we all come to New York and we think it, oh, because Willem de Kooning lived here, or someone created it, or Jack Kerouac or whatever the thing is. And then you follow that place, or you move to Springs, or you make a pilgrimage somewhere. And then you're part of, I mean, you go to a cafe that writers went to in Paris, and then you're taking a picture of it. I mean, this thing is going to happen and will never stop happening. I think what has changed is that now you can either, the money's so big in the case of Austin, so big. And then in the case of, you know, just a bar or something, that taking photos of it, it somehow transforms it when people are going to Café de Flore, because Emily in Paris was filmed there, and young girls are videoing the entire dining room and the waiters have to tell them to stop. But it's an unusual time. And I think it's all very human. Like, I don't begrudge people for going to a place they love. And if someone went to South by Southwest who'd never been there, I'm sure they would think it's great. It's, you know, there's also the Rob Report is having an event there, which tells you kind of how it's evolved into serious stuff.
You know, I think I remember Austin. I mean, I don't know like a lot of versions of Austin, right? So I can't even say I know the like 2009 to 2015 or something version of Austin, right? Which was like a popular time, but not like now and not like before it. Mm-hmm. And I remember at that time, and Twitter is like very early at that time.
Yeah.
And I just remember everyone that would go to Austin would tweet, Austin is so cool, right? It's like, that's what everyone said. And like ever since then, and my buddy yesterday was like, I think I'm going to move to Nashville. I'm like, man, I don't know that I could do it. Like, I don't know that I could move to any place that like got fully overtaken because so many people went there and thought it was cool. You know, that like to me is a very dangerous,
ooh, yeah,
dangerous thing, right? Well, I'm not saying Austin's bad. I haven't been there. I don't know. Like, I just don't love the idea of moving to a city that like everyone is there because it's cool, you know?
Yeah. I think what, you know, we went there and certain things happen for smaller cities. There's usually like an area that's down at heel. Even Soho is that way, and artists move in and interesting people move in. They fix up the places, they start to create their own things. And in that case, in the case of Austin, it's South Congress Street, you know, Liz Lambert fix up the San Jose. There was, mm-hmm, that incredible, incredible store, Uncommon Things, that then when that moved, that sort of symbolized something, but they said it was the Continental Club. And we would go to that Guero's, which was sort of like the wonderfully mediocre Mexican restaurant. But I loved that, like that bar, I've had a lot of margaritas at that bar. And I just liked that there was a mixture of people. I'm sure I was like, not who used to hang out there or whatever, but it had some feeling that you understood why people would like it. But then when you actually move to it's like going to a small bar that's not designed to be full of people, like Corner Bistro. It's like a small city like that is not designed for hundreds of thousands of people. And the traffic now is insane. The last time I was there, which was still a long time ago, I was like terrified. Like the Google Maps was like making me take these pretty hardcore left turns across oncoming traffic. And I was like, I think Austin is beyond like Google Maps, or they have to give you an option for like not cranking it across, you know, a four-way highway.
Put it into LA mode, basically. Yeah, exactly. You can't do that stuff in LA either.
And I don't know. There's something like, I feel very tenderly about that place. Cause at that time in our lives, like, I was, you know, going there and writing about music, and I love South by Southwest, though then I got older and the thing got even more out of control, the like how many people were there. And
I mean, do you remember trying to get to South Congress from like the end of like every night at South by? It's like you literally could not get there.
That's how when I realized I was not going to go back was when, so most of the music is in the higher part of the city. So these some really, really great clubs like the Mohawk and other places. So you try to get a cab at the end of the night when the shows are done, you couldn't get one. Then you're like, am I really going to get on a neon lit rickshaw or whatever the hell it is where they're playing disco music? Like, I can't. So like you walk down and you're like, oh, I'll just walk. It's still warm. And then, but then when you cross the river, like, that incline back to the San Jose is like just steeper than you want at 3 a.m. And I'm like walking up this thing, my ears are ringing, and I'm like kind of deep into this thing. I'm probably a little, you know, had some beer or whatever. And I'm like, this can't be right. Like, I can't be doing this. At that time, I was 37, I don't know, 38. Like, am I really alone 3 a.m. up a hill? Can't hear a damn thing. I'm like, this can't, to write, I don't know, for some publications, but also ACL, where you told me the lowest performing post in the history of the site, my annual South by Southwest updates, that gave me a lot of satisfaction, but they didn't really kill it.
It's funny because that sticks out to me as a memory, how poorly performing all those were. But then the other thing that I remember about all your contributions to ACL was You would come up with these like themes. You're like, I'm going to do this thing where like, it's like a man in the bar. Yeah. And like, and then you only would ever do one of them. And you
one
would
move, to two. Two, two would
move
be...
on. You have like five franchises on ECL that like are dormant after one or two things.
Man at the bar. We hit it out of the park. Andy Spade and Glenn O'Brien. Why go any further?
Yeah, just exactly. Stop,
leave it on top. We want to do it with low-level writers of other places. All right, I've got some other
let's keep topics.
Right. All right, though this was great, and I do recommend for anybody that New Yorker article. It's absolutely incredible. It talked basically Austin got a place that they were going to invest in 1982 or something. All sorts of for electronics and computer stuff that everyone thought it was going to go to Boston or San Diego, and it ended up going to Austin because it was near University of Texas, and that totally transformed the kind of, you know, Dell computers ended up being there.
It's
just a lot of interesting things about cities, public planning, people leaving California and San Francisco, moving to Austin. It touches on everything, and Lawrence Wright is an absolutely tremendous writer, and it's not like it's the classic New Yorker, do I even care about this? I kind of do. And the
and
next
then you
thing
get
you're
sucked
like,
in. Yeah.
You're like an hour later. So did you see, speaking of absolutely great articles, this really wonderful writer, Sean McCreesh, wrote this profile in the New Yorker about, you know, in New York Mag, about a woman who I didn't write her name down. She's like the crisis communication expert.
Risa Heller.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And, I know Risa. Yeah.
So great article, very much about like New York and, you know, politics, media, all those things, and crisis comms. And I had a question for you. Have you ever done crisis communications in any way? Have you ever in your career ever had to advise people when like bad news was coming out or manage something like that?
I've been around it, certainly.
Yeah.
We had a client. I don't want to go into specifics.
Yeah, of course.
We had a client that was going to be on 60 Minutes and like a full on takedown segment on 60 Minutes. And that like dragged out for a long time, and they really like are thorough, and like Morley Safer was like in our office and stuff. that came out. It was terrible. That was bad. It was kind of one of those things where it's like, there's really nothing you can do. It's just like brace for impact. And so I've seen that, like my old boss, like, you know, that Calvin Klein thing where Calvin Klein, like, you know, freaked out at the Knicks game and like ran on the court or something. Right. And then my old boss said, he's a creative guy. He gets inspired. And so that was like,
I mean,
I
think the other phrase, he was disoriented, I think may have that way. He stepped on the court.
So my old boss too would say, when like bad stuff had happened or whatever, it's like, you know, a lot of people think like, oh, we want like a retraction, right? Like something's wrong and whatever. I mean, it's one thing to get like a correction for something that's like mistaken, but like a retraction, right? So my old boss would say, like, when you're knee deep in shit, don't get down on all fours. And he's like, let's just like leave this alone. But like,
yeah, it's like the Streisand effect, right?
Yeah, exactly. I've had other things happen where like you need to like refer to someone like Risa, and you need to get like someone that can like just really handle this. And, you know, I think my big takeaway from like all that talk about her and what she does and whatever, it's like, people might not like that, right? Or think like, oh, this is like, you know, beneath me or whatever your take is on that. But when you need one of those people, right, you need that person.
Totally.
Like when it's going bad in the media, like people really, really seek out that counsel. And I think that's why she probably makes like tons of money, you know?
She, I mean, it's incredible. And there was actually a really good Sean McCreesh. I'm very into that. I think he's going to be someone who writes really great articles for the next decades and decades. Like that was a perfect New York Mag story. He was Maureen Dowd's assistant, which is like a pretty coveted job, and leads up to, and he was just on the Press Box, a really good podcast with Brian Curtis. And he's funny, fast, doesn't take it too seriously, totally understands her. I completely recommend that for anybody who cares about these things.
You're really getting around here, Coggins. You're reading a lot.
I'm waiting for my book to be returned. I got nothing to do. So I've been reading, listening, and there's no sports. It's really badly planned by the NBA. They had this week to themselves. They completely botched it.
Was like the lowest all-star ratings like in the last 20 years or something too.
And then there's no games anyway. She talks about how like most people call her on the worst day of their life, their professional life. But one of the things the first thing she says is, you have to tell me everything.
Tell me the real incredible story. Like, don't hold it back.
Tell me the real story. Tell me the worst, no surprises. But then there's this other kind of theory that like, when you're that overwhelmed, that you're actually like kind of brain chemistry changes and you can't make good decisions. So it's really, in some cases, just to calm you down and not do anything erratic. And they even called it like the squiggles or something. you're so disoriented because you know, you're used to being in powerful, you know, these are powerful people used to being in control, in a position of authority. Yeah. And now they kind of can't trust themselves to even make basic decisions about, they want to lash out. They want to like talk to the press. They want to start the story too quickly. And she completely understands the way New York media works, but beyond that, it's just like calming them down and keeping them from, as you say, get down on all fours.
The other thing, a couple of things I just want to say. If the story is really early, right? If you can like head it off before it like gets into like the bloodstream, basically, then you have a good chance. But once it's like out there, like in a big way, there's just really nothing you can do. You know, like you can't shape it further. I mean, you can react in a better way. Like Alec Baldwin is kind of like not with like what's going on with him right now in the New Mexico shooting thing, but like, like in earlier times, like he would just act, like he would just push and do other stuff that would just keep the story moving, you know?
Right.
And like, I think a lot of people don't realize, like, you just have to stop. Like, you have to like really like contain yourself and like let this thing like weather the storm, like let this thing blow through, you know? And then maybe you start to rebuild or something. You can't do it while it's like, while the storm is going on.
That's good.
You know, it's funny because I'm friends with Jared Paul Stern, who worked at the Post for a long time and worked on the, you know, Page Six, and who had like a, you know, a series of
part of the story.
Yes. A series of very negative things happened to him and his wife and whatever. And Ron Burkle running with him and whatever. But
stuff.
He would tell me stories about like Trump and
really.
Well, because I was like, you know, I know you dealt with like Trump because this isn't like inside info or anything, but he never like had a PR person, I guess, and he was really good at like playing the game. And Jared would be like, you know, he would call me with like, we'd have a story he would know before we'd run it, and then he would find me wherever I was and like give me something else like in trade and be like, here, I have this is better, like take this, don't run that story. You know, I guess like that's what I hear. This is like my hearsay on all of it. But, you know, I think like that's interesting. And like there's like definitely ways to play this game. And then if like bad things happen, then you're probably screwed, you know, and it's just going to be bad and uncomfortable, you know.
It's
and probably only try to make that mistake once, you know, like don't keep doing the same thing over and over, which would also help.
Well, especially now when there's so many, you know, narratives or whatever. Like Kyrie Irving's a good example. It's like you can stop the train going in the wrong direction by just like, you've already taken, continue the metaphor, you've already gone two stops in a bad direction. Let's just get off there. Let's not keep, it's like you on the train. Let's not keep this thing past Newark all the way to Princeton. He's just on the train into a bad place.
I think he just didn't want to deal with like his, you know, like he just didn't want to be controlled or something. I don't know. There's like, you know, who knows with that stuff. It's wild. I mean, it's sad to see. I feel bad when people like have public meltdowns or all this stuff like happens.
For sure.
Yeah.
And that leads me to my next question that's somewhat related. Say you're working for a major luxury brand and they want to publish an ad in multiple venues saying people are knocking off one of our signature things. I don't know if you saw this ad. Laura Piana puts one of their
shoes,
kind of those boots with the white sole, and then in this hideous font, way too large, says worn by those who create or something like that. And then below it, also in a huge hideous font, imitated by those who follow. I'm like, why is Laura Piana making a full page ad in the New York Times weekend, full page ad in the Financial Times? Somewhere else I saw it. I'm like, what is going on here? Isn't it cooler to just
Wall Street Journal? Yeah, it was everywhere. Wall Street Journal.
Isn't it just cooler to like make the thing and know people are knocking it off? Or do you, or you come up with some very clever, shorter, small phrase that just say like, you know, can't be imitated at any price, and you just leave it at that. But this is like, I do not understand this. What's your take on it? I shouldn't have colored it with my stronger opinions.
You're really leading the witness here, but I'm not going to take your bait and go with you. You know, I think Laura Piana is like trying to be relevant, right? I think that they're like nervous that they're just in this like billionaire zone, like the Davos zone, and they're not like, they don't appeal to anyone. And I don't know, they have like no brand, no true like brand recognition. I don't know. That's like my take on it, is I think that they, you know, they did this like weird collaboration with like that Japanese designer or whatever. And I'm like, this stuff is like so bizarre. Like, it's so far from like anything I feel like their customers would want. And the whole point of Laura Piana, which is that it's not branded totally, right?
Right,
it's like
right.
Understated luxury is the whole point. And that's like what made it great, you know?
Interesting. Good analysis.
So, yeah, I think that they're trying to like be younger or something, or be more relevant in fashion, or they're trying to have ownership or brand recognition. They probably feel like, oh, we're like getting kicked around and we shouldn't be, you know? I don't know. That's like what it seems like to me. Those shoes. You wear those, right?
No, I respect those shoes as like I like the fact that they haven't changed and that they're instantly recognizable. And I'm fascinated by people who wear them, and they've created their own kind of weird cult about them. And it seems like the people who would like them wouldn't want something that imitates them. And the people who imitate them will stop soon enough anyway, because it just is, that's cyclical, it's for like them, but it's thing. Enduring for Laura Piana. And so that, it's like, if Belgian shoes was like, you know, accept no substitute. Well, like, no kidding. That's why yours are $620 for Belgian shoes. And it's like, that's the power of that thing. And Laura Piana, it's like certain companies are cool because they're unchanged and kind of can't, it's not that they're bulletproof, but they endure in a way that's reassuring, and they shouldn't try to tempt that by being relevant, because that's going to, then they're playing a different game, one that they're not equipped for, to be honest.
Yeah.
You know, like, it would be, if they were that sort of thing, they would have been different in the first place.
I mean, I think Laura Piana is equipped, you know, it's LVMH, like they're equipped to do anything they want, right? Mm-hmm. And no, there's like no better company at managing and building luxury brands in the world than LVMH. I mean, look at Tiffany. Even if you don't like any of that stuff, like, Tiffany was irrelevant. And they've fully injected it into a conversation. But what if, like, tying this with the Eisenberg thing?
Yeah.
What if like Laura Piana bought Belgian shoes, and then they were in every Laura Piana store? Like, how would you feel about Belgian shoes?
Really good question. I think I wouldn't like them as much, because I feel like the world is, we're losing these individual things. So Berluti bought Arnie's. Arnie's, for people, I hope people listen to this. Arnie's was a store in Paris, very specific. It was too sophisticated for me when I would go there with my dad. I couldn't quite understand it, but it was very kind of whimsical French clothes. They would have like corduroy trousers and very unexpected colors. It was sort of like a French Drake's, but it's not really that, because they were more kind of hunting clothes, even sort of an Austrian vibe. And you could get suits made there, but that's not really what they specialized in. It was a wonderful store near the Galerie Lafayette, all-time place. Berluti, who goes on about, oh, we're luxury this, artisan that, bought it and put a Berluti store in and made Arnie's like is back in the corner and it's like, you can have a coat made and it just says Arnie's. They totally, you know, decommissioned it. It's like, why you go on about what you stand for and then you buy the thing that stands for that as much as anything. And then you totally defang it and it doesn't even exist. It's so sad. Mm-hmm. And to me, if you were going to buy it and let it do its thing, like all sorts of like, if,
so if they bought it and then just left the store it on its own,
yeah, or if something, yeah, like,
or if they moved the store to Fifth Avenue, but it was a better store.
Well, they're definitely, I mean, Belgian shoes is a very specific thing. I both love them and am mad at them, and that's part of the experience that you can't.
Why are you mad? Because of the pricing?
The pricing, and they're mean, and then they're just like,
it's, and they don't have anything,
no reason, and then they like screw up the basic thing, and it doesn't like, and they don't, and they, and then I like the fact that their website was simple, and now it's like complicated, but it's not better. Like you don't really need to see some of that stuff, but it's also like, it's a very powerful, if I see somebody in Belgian shoes who's interesting, they seem more interesting. And there are very few things like that. If it, when worn correctly, very few things have the upside of a Belgian shoes on a woman, on a man, on a old person, on a young person, on a hot person, on a fat, overweight, whatever it is, like I am for it. If you can like pull that off, you are into the next zone. And there are very few things like that.
Let me say something just building on that. That's a really interesting observation, right? And to me, and everyone says, you know, being interested in, not everyone, but a lot of people think being interested in clothing is just irrelevant. But in my opinion, if you understand shoes, you understand the world. Like if you understand the shoes that people wear, right? Mm. You know, like you, if you see someone wearing Belgians, you can tell, you know, like 20 things about them, right? If you see someone wearing the Loro Piana shoe, like it's a real thing. Like you can tell what people are like generally, I think, based on their footwear. It's weird. Strong. Yeah.
Very strong, very good, and slightly upsetting because the shoe game of most people is appalling, and it shouldn't be. It's one of the easiest things to do. And when I see, I mean, it's said that like women notice men's shoes. Like I notice everyone's shoes because you can't really recover from that too, you know, and you don't. And it's not that it has to be as unique and forward thinking as Belgian shoes. Like just I'm so obsessed with Alden loafers. Like I can't get any more pleasure out of that from someone. Or just, we mentioned Andy Spade earlier. He would wear the desert boots, but with like colored laces. And it was so specific to him and it was so great. And it was, you know, Glenn O'Brien, RIP, who wore Belgian shoes and wrote about them in a way that made me understand them better. He's like, they veer towards dandiness, but in fact, they're fierce and fearless. And it took me a while to get to that place because they are slightly dangerous in that way. And, you know, it's interesting when people do, like, there just aren't very many things that haven't been gobbled up, you know, or used in some other way. And so I like it when there's a place, like there's a restaurant and there's only one of them, or I like the idea for the most part that like Eric Repair walks through Central Park to Le Bernardin and it's in the kitchen every day. Mm-hmm. He could have 10 restaurants, 100, whatever. He could have one in Las Vegas. He could do, could expand, and that he's there means something to me. And when you have that experience with a company or a place that does something a certain way, it's really nice. I mean, I was thinking about what it used to mean to go to Barney's or even Bergdorf Goodman, the way it kind of used to be, and how, like what the windows meant, that you would go to see them, that you would go when you were young and couldn't afford the things, go to look at the clothes and how, and the people who work there, and that you would learn from how to style something from the mannequins and from the ads and from just looking at things on sale in the store, and just that you could see that many freaking trench coats in one place. It was great. I would just, and we don't have that. We don't have a way to learn, and you're not ever going to have that experience online. I just don't think it's the same thing. You don't know how it feels or how it looks, even the color, you can't quite understand it. And I wish we had those, we're not learning the same way.
Yeah. I think it's hard to like have critical mass at this point with, you know, a one physical thing, and just like it's such a different world than it used to be, right? And the way that all these businesses function. But that's like a whole other topic.
Yeah. I mean, we can talk. I'm very interested in the idea of like how something can work at a mass level or how something can work at a very, very micro level. And, you know, it's too bad that kind of Brooks Brothers didn't work at the mass level at the end, or even in mm-hmm. late stage. And that's really too bad. And it does make me appreciate certain parts of, I'm much more kind of appreciative of like Ralph Lauren now than I used to be. I think I took it for granted. It's just like Bruce Springsteen. It's just like, yeah, he's great. Whatever. It's Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I'm like, wait, that doesn't just happen. Or he got to a point and maintained it, or he toured, or they have these stores, or they have this, like the level of obsession. Like you're looking at our, you know, going back to your expenses for the previous year, I would like to know what the flower budget is at the Ralph Lauren mansion. It's insane, I'm sure. And it's like, the attention to that, or like how often they change the rugs, or I don't even know, like things that have nothing to do with the clothes, like that's real. And that affects all sorts of other things to make that place so magical. And I think at one point I just thought, well, like, obviously that's how it is. It's the mansion. It's like, no, it isn't. There's 8,000 decisions that go into it, and people prioritizing it and loving it and trying to do that. And that's why that's great. And I think I miss that more and more, because there are fewer places like that where you can have a physical experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ralph Lauren is really special in the way that they've been able to maintain it over the years. And just like the interest in quality and make and all this stuff there is pretty, pretty amazing. I mean, I think just to like wrap all this up to some degree, you know, there's an issue now where everything has to be the best, right? Or like the cheapest. Mm. And there's like, and that's like the world generally. It's like, Brooks Brothers couldn't just build a normal business, a decent business with good product, not the best product, but nothing like in the middle can survive. So there's just no place for that. Okay. And that's like, we see that everywhere, you know? So, but.
Well, oh man, that's so, I don't know how that's going to work for our middle ground.
That's why our middle ground will work. I actually got a few messages from people that are like, this is a great idea. You should do it. I'm like,
middle ground.
We're going to lose money, so Coggins, if we do it. You know that.
No. Guaranteed. I'm working on the subhead or the tagline. Like, is it unfussy coffee, or is it like coffee without the fuss? We're workshopping this. We'll get there.
I don't think fuss is a word anyone really wants to see or use.
Okay. All right. Good. All right. Noted. We'll put that in the style guide.
Take that back to the take these notes back.
I think that, so I have one other very small thing to talk about that's related to this. I was looking, screwing around on eBay. I forgot to write it down. I'm not as prepared as I thought. Now, this is the khaki update. The chinos situation on RRL, they now have three, where before there was one, and now there's three, and it's like military chino, officer's chino, and then chino pant. And the descriptions of each one are totally interchangeable. Like you can hardly tell them apart. So it's totally confusing. And then I realized, I went online and I was on eBay, and there was like Bill's khaki. And I wrote you, speaking of old ACL, possibly before we met, asking you what your favorite Bill's khaki was. So here I am giving people a hard time about asking me about khakis. I asked you about Bill's khaki, never bought. I never could understand. This is 15 years ago, probably. And you, at that point, were building your audience and every site, and were nice and answered everything. And it was very funny that you wrote back about whichever one was like not the ones that were like fit five times too big or whatever. Cause that
M2,
was
M2. I remember exactly what I like. M2, M1's like the real, like World War II huge leg one, MacArthur pant. And the M2 is like more slim, but he has a new brand. So did you see that thing Chicago?
Hold
story?
On. Is Bill's khaki still exists? Not exist? Is that all dead stock?
Well, it got sold. I think it still exists. But it's not out there as much. I'm not totally sure the state of it at the moment. But it's not what it was, because the guy, Bill Thomas, who started it, is not involved anymore. Yeah. But he has like a new line called Pen Built.
Right.
And it's like, I think he took some of the learnings from Bill's, and it's different fits. It's like a, you know,
Yeah.
He was at Chicago. Anyway, I just ordered some pants from him.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, well, I'm gonna try them out. Yeah.
Oh, and last thing about S&P, terrible music, super loud, had to wear my headphones, do not need hip hop or whatever it is. R&B,
what was it?
At 11 in the morning, like loud R&B in a place that should be quiet to nothing. And it's just like booming in the morning and really like heavy beats. And I'm like, this is crazy. I'm trying to digest food here. Good show, Michael. Great to talk to you. I'm probably a little spring break next week. So possibly no, a week off Central Division and,
good.
And we're going to, we can amass some good topics for 2 weeks from now.
That sounds good.
All right. Take care, Michael.
All right. Bye.